Welcome to Christian Historical Fiction Talk. I'm your host, author Liz Tolson, and I'm so glad to have you along today, because if it's happening in the world of Christian historical fiction, we are talking about it right here. Welcome to all of you who are new to the show. I promise I don't always sound like this. I am recovering from some kind of really nasty virus, so I'm limping along this week. I appreciate you putting up with it. But I'm so glad to have you here. Please be sure to subscribe to Christian Historical Fiction Talk on your favorite podcasting platform so that you know when I release new episodes, which is just about every week. Want you to stay in the loop and stay in touch. Also connect with us on Facebook, X, Instagram, and Pinterest. We are in all of those places. That's a great way to keep up with us and to get input on shows and to find out what's coming up. To all of you who are returning listeners, thank you so much for your loyal support. I really do appreciate it. You have contributed to the success of Christian Historical Fiction Talk. I have one small ask of you. Please go over to my website, which is liztolsma.com. Click on the Patreon link that is right on the front page. Check that out. See what you can do to further support the podcast and what benefits I have for you if you do so. I really do appreciate that. Okay, I am going to give my scratchy voice a rest, and I am going to introduce you to Jocelyn Green, a returning guest who is here to talk about her latest release, The Hudson Collection. Welcome back to the show, Jocelyn. It's so good to have you with us again.
It's great to be here.
We were saying off the air that it's been a little while, but I'm so glad that we could reconnect again to talk about your new book, The Hudson Collection. But before we get into that, why don't you just remind the listeners who you are?
Sure. I'm Jocelyn Green. I write historical fiction. I live in Cedar Falls, Iowa with my husband, two teenagers, and four cats.
Wow. It's quite the houseful.
Yes, it is.
So as I said, the new book is called The Hudson Collection, and it's the second book in this series, but they're standalones, aren't they?
They are. Each book has a different protagonist, and all three of the protagonists for these novels are roommates, or at least that's how they start out in the Metropolitan Affair. So they, you know, there's some character overlap, but it's a separate story for each novel.
I loved the Metropolitan Affair, and I will admit that I have not had a chance to read the Hudson Collection yet, but sure. It sounds so good. I'm really looking forward to it. Tell the listeners about the Hudson Collection.
Okay. Well, the Hudson Collection is the story of Elsa, who you met in the Metropolitan Affair. Elsa is Lauren's cousin and roommate, and Elsa works at the American Museum of Natural History as an ornithologist, which means she works with birds. She studies and researches with birds. She's also a polio survivor. And this has more to do with the plot than I originally thought it would when I was developing her character for the first book. But the whole premise of the Hudson Collection is that an elderly woman dies and she leaves her bird collection to the museum. She lives in a Gothic country estate. And before the museum wants to accept all of the birds, it's Elsa's job to go out to the estate, which is, you know, miles outside of Manhattan, and find out if there are field notes and if they need these birds, catalog them, make sure they're in good shape. But while she's there, she gets involved in kind of a treasure hunt for something else that this woman has willed to the daughter of the gardener. And the daughter of the gardener is neurologically atypical. If we were writing this story in, you know, today's day and age, we would recognize that she is on the autism spectrum disorder. but that was not very understood back then. So we've got a lot of interesting characters in this book. And part of the reason I wanted to have some aspects of these characters that were atypical, whether it's being a polio survivor and having lingering chronic illness effects or just being neurologically atypical, was that the 1920s was also the peak of the eugenics movement in America. And for those who aren't familiar with that term, eugenics was just this idea that we can breed the perfect human product, just like we can breed blue ribbon cows for the county fair. And so there was this striving for the perfect human. And it's kind of shameful to say, but this whole concept of eugenics, even though it died out in America pretty soon after my story is set, Germany and Hitler picked up on this eugenics thing, and they really used that in their quest for, you know, the perfect Aryan race. So pairing characters who society would say will not live up to this perfect human product standard and placing them in an era where that was a thing, it's very uncomfortable for the characters, but rich with possibilities for an author. And hopefully it makes for, you know, a slightly more interesting story than it would otherwise.
Yeah. So now I'm wondering which question to talk about first, but we'll go with the layering in this story. I've heard some early reviewers say it's just so layered and so rich and so deep. I mean, you have the heroine with polio, the World War II veteran, the young girl who is on the autism spectrum, an ornithologist. How did you go about developing this whole book and these layers that make up the story?
Thank you. You know, I'm kind of chuckling to myself because it hasn't even occurred to me that anyone is reading this book yet, but it sounds like they are. Oh my, now I'm nervous. How did I come up with it? I think it just started with one character at a time. It started with Elsa. And then as she goes to this estate, then I knew I wanted to have an older woman who was the child's mother. She gave birth to the child a little bit later in life, and the child herself. And, you know, as we authors sometimes do, we think, what would make this obstacle even more poignant for the characters? What would make things worse? And so I just started developing characters that were outside of the norm. And you mentioned the World War I veteran. Yes, that's another character who, he has physical scars, and his buddy who works with him has more internal scars. So it's like we've come up with this group, this little motley crew of all of these characters who have something that makes them different. And as far as the ornithology, that was kind of just put into place before I even started writing book one. We just were thinking of, well, the name of the series is On Central Park. So we were thinking, which institutions are on Central Park, which characters can work where. So that's one of those things that was set in place. And then I just had to figure out how to make that more interesting as I went along.
Definitely. And so then the eugenics is all tied into that. And being a World War II author myself, I'm familiar with the eugenics movement in the United States and how that carried over to Germany. But then sort of extrapolating that to today with, you know, these quote unquote designer babies that, mm-hmm. you know, people are creating via IVF and all that. Talk about how that old eugenics movement still is part of our society today?
Ooh, that is such a big question. Well, and I think that there is definitely the designer baby thing with IVF. Now, that's something that not all of us would, you know, be able to say, yes, we're doing this, but we can all admit to, at least the women, using cosmetics and, you know, at least if not buying into all of these anti-aging products that are marketed to us, at least kind of paying attention to the claims. I think that all of us have this innate thing in our human nature that tells us that we want to be the best version of ourselves. And that's not wrong, but we have to decide where the line is. And the IVF babies, that's a whole different thing.
Yes.
And I think the danger is when we think that we have the power to create people who are, you know, they're made in the image of God, but we're so focused on their outward appearance mostly. And, you know, if we're trying to engineer their IQs, then does that mean that someone who does not quite reach that same level of beauty, or someone who doesn't have that same IQ, are they less in the image of God? Do they have less worth as a human, less dignity, less value? Do we treat them differently? So yeah, you're right. There are some parallels, and there are things that all of us could just kind of take a minute to examine in how we view ourselves and others who don't look or behave the way we do.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Ashley T. Lee Podcast. Join me to hear the Bible read line by line and clearly explained. Listen to the Word of God in your car or home or work while it transforms your mind daily. Romans 12:2 says, "Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, which is good and acceptable and perfect." Knowing the Bible can give you peace and joy in this hectic world. Listen weekly to Ashley T. Lee Podcast on all podcast sites.
Thank you for handling that tough question that I just lobbed at you with a lot of grace and tact. I do appreciate that. It's something that's near and dear to my heart as mm-hmm. a mom of a child with special needs. And I was recently ill and spent a lot of time, too much time probably watching YouTube videos because it's about all I had the energy to do. And mm-hmm. watched a lot about what's happening in the world, listened to a bunch of podcasts. And so that's sort of been in the forefront of my mind. So that's another reason why this book just really intrigues me with its examination of people who maybe don't quite reach that standard of, like you said, beauty and physical traits, intellectual traits that we are looking for.
So. Sure. And the other question is, who makes those standards, you know, and like how do we get to be the ones to decide what perfection is or what is ideal? So it's so subjective, and there are a lot of potential pitfalls there whenever we start assigning value to certain traits that we don't have any control over.
Exactly. So you have some very fun, random historical tidbits in this book. Tell us about a few of them that you came across along the way.
Oh man, I can tell you about one that really stands out in my mind. I had learned that while I was writing this, someone had gotten into a Central Park Zoo way back in the day in the 1920s and a bird got out. But also during the writing of this novel, the same thing happened in Central Park. You know, just a couple of years ago, some vandal like used a wire cutters and he made an opening in a bird enclosure. And so Flacco, the Eurasian eagle owl, got out and everybody said, now this is what happened in recent history. This was not in the 20s. This was recently. Everyone said this owl will not survive outside of captivity because he won't know how to hunt. He won't know how to feed himself. But lo and behold, he sure did. And I love that story. He survived in Central Park and in Manhattan far longer than anybody thought he would. And he did the whole hunting thing. And so I used that as inspiration in the novel because it's this whole parallel of we say that we can't do certain things, but what if we just haven't been given the opportunity to try? So that was one. So I was following quite closely the story of Flacco, the Eurasian eagle owl. It didn't end the way I wanted it to, but his end came after the book was printed. So I'm sorry about that, but he was definitely an inspiration.
I remember that being on the news, and that's a really neat parallel that ties into your book. That's really cool how that worked out. So the first book you had to learn about Egyptology.
Right.
And now this book, your heroine is an ornithologist. So you had to, I'm assuming, learn a lot about birds. You sort of touched on that. What kind of research did you do to learn about all these different kinds of birds?
Well, I have a lot of books about birds and bird behavior. And I tried to focus on birds that would have been in the location at the time and at the time of year. And thankfully, I came across an article written by someone who worked at the Museum of Natural History, and it was a guide to birding in Central Park, and it was month by month. And it told me like which little visitors you could expect to see almost even week by week and where they were and why they were special. So that was a gold mine of research. Other research would be just like watching documentaries and following a bird photographer on Instagram and subscribing to Cornell University has this like ornithology lab. I don't remember what it's called, bird lab or something. So just being able to tap into all kinds of resources. I just had to be careful that I did not use research that was not available back in the 1920s. So we know things now that we didn't know back then. So as I'm doing this research, I, you know, if it says we, you know, we learned this in the 1890s that this crow can actually create tools and solve problems. Well, that was really cool. So I was able to use that. But there are other things that I couldn't use because my characters wouldn't have been able to know about it yet.
Oh, wow. Isn't it funny how authors need to learn these weird things, and we have this whole treasure trove of these off the wall facts that we learn along the way.
Yes, it is. And one of the facts you asked about random stuff, and I could all I could think of was Flacco at the time because he's near and dear to my heart. But I did learn a lot of bird facts, especially that crows can remember faces. And they hold grudges. So if you are mean to a crow, watch out because he will go get his buddies and they will harass you. So I thought that was really interesting.
So I read on your bio that red is your favorite color. And then I saw the cover to this book, which is stunning. And I loved the one for the Metropolitan Affair, but I think this one's even better. How did you go about getting them to put a red dress on the woman on the front cover?
You know, they just did it. I don't know if I even mentioned anything about it, but I knew that we wanted to do a monochromatic background the way we did for the Metropolitan Affair, and that whatever the figure was wearing had to be a bright pop of color. So red is a great candidate for that. And yes, I love the way that red dress looks on her.
It's stunning. I absolutely adore that cover. So well done to that cover designer.
That's great.
Also in your bio, I love that you say that you're an ordinary person and you do ordinary things like have a dirty house and try to keep up with laundry. That's so relatable to everybody.
Oh, good.
Have you ever had one of those moments where somebody comes up to you and is like, oh, I can't believe I get to meet an author. I'm so excited. Tell us about that.
Oh, goodness. Well, usually when that takes place, I mean, it could be at a book signing, but I have not done solo book signings in quite some time. So normally when they're meeting me, I'm one of several authors at a conference or a retreat. And it's always gratifying and humbling when they are excited to meet me because I'm excited to meet them too. I mean, especially, you know, there are bloggers out there and podcasters like you, Liz, and Bookstagrammers who really support authors in ways that you know, we authors could not do what we're doing without the kind of support that others give us in those ways. And my word, these bookstagrammers just make pure art, don't they, with some of their posts. Like, I cannot ever, ever hope to do that, but I'm sure glad they do.
Yes. I love those bookstagrammers because, like you, I just can't do anything like that. How they pull it together is beyond me. It's pretty amazing, and I'm grateful for them as well.
For sure.
So you also love Scrabble, and I'm sure you have a Scrabble story to share, like one of your greatest triumphs or one of your biggest failures or something like that.
Okay. So... It's funny the things you bring up, Liz, but my biggest story about Scrabble is that I am the perpetual loser. Like, you would not think this, right? But I cannot. I mean, yes, I can put words in certain orders to make a novel, but as far as like triple word scores and using up the Q and the Z, I cannot to save my life win Scrabble. So there you go.
And I'm right there with you. I'm no good at those kinds of games. Absolutely terrible at it.
It's fun to try, but I always lose.
Yes. Oh, I'm terrible at games, but I love to play them. So
that's good.
I'm right there with you. So we know you have a very busy life right now, a lot going on, but we really, really hope that there's another book in this series. So tell us what you're working on now.
Well, I am working on book 3 in the series, and this one focuses on Ivy. She's the third roommate, and she works at the New York Historical Society. So instead of nature or ancient art, we will be exploring more historical aspects, like New York history, revolutionary history. Because one thing that was really fun for me to realize in the writing of the Hudson Collection was that 1926 was a big year in American history because it was the 150th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Oh, yeah. So that gives Ivy all kinds of events that she's doing, and she's doing... Now, this doesn't sound very exciting at all. I was about to say she does some genealogy research. That's off scene, you know, but she needs to dig into people's family stories. And there, of course, will be a little bit more of a mystery and more intrigue, not quite the same as the Metropolitan Affair. You know, we had a hero who was a police detective, and that really allowed us to get into a little bit of the seedy side of the 1920s. We do not have a police detective hero in book 2 or 3. But still interesting. And even though this series is set in more modern history than I'm used to writing, I hope that there will still be enough historical interest to keep my readers satisfied.
Oh, I think so. If it's anything like the Metropolitan Affair, these books are going to be great and full of history, full of interesting history. And I can't wait for the next. Well, I have to read this one first, but I'm already anticipating the next one.
Aw, thank you.
So if listeners would like to connect with you so that they can keep up with what's going on and when your books are releasing, how can they go about doing that?
Well, thank you for asking. The first step would be to just visit my website, which is jocelyngreen.com. If you want to sign up for my newsletter, you can do that on the homepage. Just scroll down to the footer. But if you want to follow on social media, all of my handles and links are in the contact tab.
All right, that sounds great. Well, Jocelyn, thank you so much for taking time out to come and chat with us about the Hudson Collection. It sounds absolutely fantastic. It's up towards the top of my to-be-read pile. Just haven't made it yet, but so glad that you stopped by. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Liz. It's always fun.
Well, that was a lovely chat, as we always have with Jocelyn. I shouldn't be surprised at how lovely all of these Christian historical fiction authors are, but they are across the board just wonderful people. They are very much as you hear them, and they are just delightful people and love to come on and talk about their books and historical fiction and history, and always have a good time with each and every one of these authors. If you would like to learn more about the Hudson Collection or get a link to purchase the book, or would like to learn more about Jocelyn Green and connect with her, then head over to liztolsma.com. The show notes will either be on the front page or under the podcast tab. So check that out and pick up a copy of the Hudson Collection. I'm going to read it, and I know I'm going to love it. This is the point in the show where I usually tell you who is coming up next week, but because I have been without a voice for a few weeks now, I've had to postpone a couple of interviews, and I honestly don't know how we're going to end up switching and juggling everything at this point. So it's as much a surprise to me as it is to you who is going to be my guest next week. I have a few episodes that have been recorded already before I was sick, but I don't know the order that they're all going to fall in. So I appreciate your patience with all of this as we rearrange the schedule. By the next time I record, hopefully I will have everything all set and I will know, but maybe that's just going to intrigue you to come back next week and find out who the mystery guest is going to be. I hope you do just that. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to stop by and to support these authors and to support the podcast. It really does mean a lot to me. I hope you have a wonderful week, and we will see you next time.